Hey, welcome to Life 2.0 Podcast. I am John St. Augustine. Glad to have you joining me from anywhere and everywhere around planet Earth. Time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor, make sense out of the senseless, and all together now, find the obvious buried in the absurd. Let's get to it. All right. I've been off for a couple of weeks since the last podcast on New Year's Eve. Thank you to all of you who have sent me notes from literally all over the world. You know, I think about the technology that allows me to sit here in a very cold Chicago this morning with a nice hot cup of Dead River coffee imported from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and be able to connect with people just by clicking a few buttons and doing some editing and uploading and making a left turn at Albuquerque and everything's good. But that December 31st show that I did with Connie Reeder, who was John's backup singer for 15, 18 years, her husband, Roger Nichols, the immortal Roger Nichols, was John's engineer and producer on a few of his records and the one record that John actually got a Grammy for. But it was a huge outpouring. Whenever I do podcasts that have music in them, the John Denver tribute comes to mind. John Barry has been an oftentimes guest. Those pop big time. You know, they get posted on social media, and the fan base for these credible performers is still intact. Obviously, John Barry's still a viable voice in country music with some great stuff coming up. And John Denver, even though he's been gone a very long time, his legacy continues, and people will not put that down. That's what most of the notes that I received said. We will not let him go because he gave us something. He reminded us of something, the best within ourselves, and you don't let that go. So thank you so much for that. But I have taken a couple of weeks off, end of the year, and letting everything roll downhill, let the bones rest, as they say. But ramping up for 2022, I hope that the first couple weeks of the year have found you doing well. I got to tell you, it's those 2 weeks off for me every year, I just kind of stop. It's great retrospective. I think, you know, I keep a pace that's pretty vigorous. And I turned 63 a few weeks ago, just before, it was December 29th, now you know. But I got to tell you, that whole age is just a number thing is real to me. You know, I've been diligently working out since I was 14 or 15 years old. And it has been, I think, the saving grace for me. To get in some sort of shape. I am definitely not in the shape I was when I was 50 or 40 or 30, but for 63, I'm good with it. You know, the pants fit pretty good. I can go in the gym and it doesn't hurt too much. And I contribute and decide that that all is a part and parcel of the specific adaptation to imposed demands, the basics of kinesiology, which means that your body responds to the demand placed on it or not. And it's a lot of work. It's maintenance, but so what, now what, right? I mean, you got to do it anyway, or not. Everything's all about choice. So as I sit here a few weeks into 2022, the first thing I wanted to just kind of get off my chest is I've never once been someone who believed in resolutions, making a big New Year's resolution. They fail. They fail 99% of the time. I worked in the health club industry for about 5, 6, 7 years as a personal trainer, got certified and all that stuff, made sense at the time. And I can tell you that back then, I don't know how it is now, but back then in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, people, they couldn't wait for Christmas and it to roll around because everybody would come out and buy health club memberships. And then we couldn't wait for January to and February to roll around because the people who bought the memberships rarely showed up, maybe twice. So they were making money on people who weren't working out. And I've never understood that. I've always felt that if you invest a little bit in something that you're doing, you're more apt to stay with it. But what do I know? Apparently not. I think the days of those long-term health contracts are probably gone by the wayside. I'm not sure. I had friends of mine that, you know, they were signed up 7 generations deep. You could never get out of it kind of deal. But I think that's changed a little bit. But back in the day, that's how it was. And so my whole thing about resolutions is don't make them. And if you want to make them very short-term. Like, today I'll do this. Not this next year I'm going to lose 35 pounds. It's just too much for the brain to take in. And by the way, before I start on to other things, what this show's actually about, whatever weight you've gained, you can figure it's going to take you twice as long to get rid of it as it took you to get it. Getting it's easy. Just sit down with a bag of M&Ms and stuff. Listen, I am as guilty as anybody, but the only saving grace is I know the next day I'm going to be busting my ass on a treadmill. So it's kind of a give and take. You know, I'm to the point in my life where I'm going to do the things I enjoy doing. I watch what I do, but I keep it in moderation. But just don't make these long-term goals that set you back because it's a setup to do so. Never works out. Keep it short and simple and right to the point. Like this show. I should keep it short and simple and right to the point. I'm only 5 minutes in, and that's not too bad. What I really wanted to talk about today is Pete Hutlinger. And Pete Hutlinger passed away 6 years ago today. He was a world-class guitarist. He was one of the most, I don't even know, I got words for Pete, how to say this. As you hear this interview that I did with Pete and his wife, Erin Morris Hutlinger, back in 2015 that aired, I believe, I'm trying to remember how this worked out. I think it aired in December of 2015 or November of 2015, and then Pete passed in January of 2016, just a few short months later. I can't remember exactly where this aired or when it aired. I know where it aired on CBS, but I don't exactly remember the scheduling. So anyway, it was in months of doing this show that Pete passed. He'd been battling his whole life with a condition that has all of his organs in his body reversed on the other side. Very rare condition. How he made it as long as he did, because he was supposed to. So he's this world-class guitarist, backed up the likes of the aforementioned John Denver and a bunch of other people. He was a virtuoso. And he and his wife, Erin, wrote a book called Joined at the Heart. And I invited him to be on the show, and I wanted to air this today. You know, I get these timelines in the back of my head, and I make little notes on my desk. Actually on a piece of paper. I don't write on the actual desk. I write on paper. And one of the timelines is there is people who've passed away and when that was. And I've come over the years to realize for myself, the reason I do that is to keep reminding myself that nobody gets out of life alive. Never happens. And if you got up today and your face isn't in the obituary page, that's a good thing. That no matter what else is going on, you can overcome something. As I mentioned, these little, you know, short-term goals that you can battle through it another day. Listen, I want to get to the interview because it's fairly lengthy, but I could do a whole rollout, and maybe I will in a few weeks, about, you know, what we do with the time that we have. Just this past week, a former teacher of mine from Schurz High School, Mr. Jeff Burke, passed away 5 days ago. He was 81. And massive impact. This is a guy who was short of stature, but out, I mean, his life was larger than his shadow. Affected thousands of kids' lives with his drama and productions and stage productions, and just an impactful guy. And I had not seen him for 45 years. And we do this big event every year called the Bulldog Bash. And Jeff showed up finally, and he was just the king of the castle that night. Everybody loves the guy. And we had 175 people there. And to see him there and light up the room, along with a few other teachers who I've not seen for years, is why we do this. We get people together because we know that tomorrow's promised to no one. And so I was so glad to see Jeff in October, this past October 2021. And the news of his passing, of course, is sad. But then I immediately flip it. I have to. This is what works for me. I flip it to the fact that, but he was here. You know, imagine him not ever being here and making the impact that he made and doing the things that he did and affecting the people that he affected. That would be a much poorer life that way. So I have these reminders of the people who have passed, friends of mine and family and like that, as reminders of how you live your life while you're here, because tomorrow is not promised. And we should be going about our lives that way, because there are 150,000 people that left the planet overnight that were here yesterday, not here today. And at some point, that's us, you and I. And have no illusion about it, right? I mean, come on. It's fascinating to me that Betty White makes it to 99, just weeks shy of her 100th birthday, and leaves. And, you know, there's a great outpouring, as there should be, for her talent. I just don't think it's a tragedy, personally. She made 99 years. What a life she lived. She used it up. And I think if you go about using it up, it's not tragic when you leave. Use it up. Use it up. And Pete Hutlinger is a guy who definitely used it up. So on the sixth anniversary of Pete's passing, I say the same thing. The world is a much less musical place with him gone, but it is a far better place because he was here. So here's my interview with Pete and Aaron from 2015. Enjoy.
You're listening to Life Matters with John St. Augustine.
I'm overlooking Lake Michigan on the 10th floor of CBS Radio Studios here. It is. I'm giving you a little play-by-play here. I always used to like to do that for baseball when I was in college, a little play-by-play. It's a dark, dreary day, and there are flecks of snow in the air, and the flowers of summer have come and gone. But on the cover of this book, Joined at the Heart, there's a marigold, which is permanent in its message. It's a story of love, guitars, resilience, and marigolds. Pete Hudlinger and Aaron Morris Hudlinger are the authors of the book. And I mentioned before meeting Pete briefly it had to be in 2010. Annie Denver did a book signing for me at one of the local stores in Aspen. And I went to this tribute concert at the Opera House there. I think it's called the Wheeler Opera House. And I'd never been around anything like that. John and I were friends for years, and I never connected with any of that stuff after he had died. But I sat at this concert, and I was just stunned by the energy and the love and the respect and the tribute that went on. But anyway, they did this thing afterwards, met briefly, and I knew Pete's work from, you know, spending time with Eric Clapton and all this other, Leanne Rimes, and a world-class guitar player and instructor. And I didn't get, until this book came out, the backside of all this stuff. As I started the show talking about M. Scott Peck and how life is difficult, we see people on stage and we go, wow, they got it made, and I'd do anything to have what you have. And then they look at you and say, maybe not. So anyway, it's a great book. It just came out, and they both joined me from the Music City, Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome to the show, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, John. It's good to be with you.
So is it true, Aaron, that you guys were listening to one of the shows I did on Thanksgiving or somewhere? You were traveling and you were listening?
Yeah, we were driving back actually from checkups in Houston, Texas, where we travel back to every 6 months, and we were coming back from there and listening to one of your episodes. I think it was number 4. I think it had a curse word in the title.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I had to ask the people in New York, because I'm a Chicago guy. Sometimes shit comes out of my mouth. What can I say? And I said, do I have to take it out? They're like, no, this is on demand. You can say anything you want. So, you know, freedom.
That's scary.
It is scary. But you should see the stuff I take out. I do edit. So there you go. But the reason I brought that up is because you figured out how to listen in the car before I did, and it's my show. So thanks. I have no idea. No clue.
It's very easy.
Well, that's good.
That's a different interview.
That is a different interview. I want to talk about this book. When you sent this to me, I had some inklings of some of the things that have happened. I mentioned, and I think, Aaron, you and I talked briefly in 2010 in Aspen. I had no idea, until people reading this book will have no idea, the massive changes and challenges that have gone in your life over the last few years. It all started, Pete, when you were a little kid. My first thought was, I'm reading this, I'm trying to go in some sort of order with the notes I made. Number one is, how many people in the world are born with the organs on the opposite side of their body? Not many,
but there are a lot of us. Yeah.
You guys have like a club or?
No, but what you normally see is someone with maybe the heart on the wrong side, or the lungs could be reversed, or the stomach's on the wrong side. But with me, all my organs are reversed. So my stomach's on the opposite side, liver's on the opposite side, lungs are reversed, heart's on the wrong side, and my heart's turned backwards. And the wires, or not the wires, but the plumbing in my heart is all screwed up too.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, on one hand, I always talk about on this show that, you know, people are always out buying lottery tickets, forgetting that just being born is like winning the lottery, but you like won it twice to be able to overcome all that. And as I read through the book, a seemingly fairly normal life, even with all that going on when you were a kid.
Yeah, well, you know, I had a large family, and my mom wanted me to be raised like every other kid in the family. So I had chores and all that stuff. You know, I just couldn't go out and run with my brothers. So I got in a lot less trouble than they did.
When you first picked up a guitar, how old were you?
I was 8 the first time I played. I took lessons with one of my brothers. We were in a class, and then he quit. So I quit because I was too scared to go by myself. So then when I was nine, my sister married a guy from Virginia, Tom Vigor, and his whole family came out from Virginia to our place in California, and they had banjos and guitars and fiddles and mandolins and all these instruments I had never seen before, and I started playing banjo at that point, and then switched over to guitar when I was 13 or 14. And never looked back.
I was going to say, did you know, was there a point that you knew that this is like an extension of your body? Did you know this would be your route? Did you just, I mean, was there a point where like this all makes sense even if you were a young guy?
Well, when I was 15, I found out that people actually make a living playing music. I thought you can have this much fun and be paid.
Right.
It was, I mean, that idea was a total foreign concept to me. And so at that point, I said, well, I'm going to figure out a way to make this happen. And, you know, I've had some very lucky breaks throughout the years. And that combined with, 30, 40 years of hard work has paid off.
So you have all this physical stuff going on. The guitar speaks to you. You're able to connect with that and move forward. And I know as we go through this conversation, it's going to become apparent to people listening how healing it is to be able to have music in your life and obviously to create the music and do those things. But when you two guys met, Aaron, you were doing a lot of publicity and all that kind of stuff, and I think you guys actually met while Pete was backing up John. Is that right?
Well, no, we met at the very first tribute show in Aspen at the Wheeler Opera House. It was the one-year anniversary of John's death.
Yeah.
And it was the first tribute show, and I was actually there working with Jim Horn, who you know. And so that's where we met, actually. So that would have been 1998.
So when you look at that time, you know, again, I'm looking for a convergence of energies here because, you know, it starts out over here and this is what's going on in Pete's life as a young guy and he's working his way toward, and you guys are kind of headed towards each other. And I don't want to jump too far down the line, but the thing I got most out of this book, I mean, I got a lot out of this book. By the way, it's called Joined at the Heart, and John Oates wrote the foreword to the book. It's almost like you guys were destined to be together and there was no other way that this could unravel itself or go the route it would with you if you were in different places at different times. I just had this overwhelming sense of fate almost. Has that got to be part of your lives?
I kind of feel that way. I mean, I can look back and I can certainly feel that way, but sometimes I joke with Pete and tell him, you know, as a young person, I always wanted to be John Denver's guitar player, and I quickly realized that I was not willing to put in that much practice time, so I just instead married John Denver's guitar player, and it was a real short time. So in that way, we were destined.
Yeah, there you go. Well, kind of fulfilled a lifelong ambition, just a little
That's
bit
right.
different. So let's start with this medical stuff. For quite a long time in your life, Pete, you did fairly well, and you lived with it and dealt with it and did those things. When did things really start going downhill? When did you know? Was it the Copper Mountain trip was the big thing, or was it before that?
It had been going on for quite some time. But let me back up. So I was born with this condition. It's a very long name, so I won't go into what it's called. But basically, all my organs are reversed, and my heart's on the wrong side. It's turned backwards, and the smaller ventricle for my heart pumps to my whole body, and the large ventricle pumps to the lungs, which is the opposite of yours and most other people's.
Huh.
So I knew at some point in my life things were going to get bad. But I had heart surgery when I was 13 at Stanford Medical University in Palo Alto, California, by Dr. Shumway, who was the preeminent guy in the world at the time. And so he did surgery and repaired a few things. I had a couple of holes in my heart that were they were keeping me from going outside and playing for more than 5 or 10 minutes at any given stretch. And so that, then all of a sudden I could start running. So I started running. And it took me a couple of years after that before I ran my first mile. And that, and I never looked back. I started running, and things were really good. I was kind of a chubby kid and I got skinny, and that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be thin like my brothers, and I led a very normal life. I mean, I hiked, I ran, I canoed, I traveled the world, things were great. And then when I was about, 40, something like that, things started getting a little tougher. Workouts were getting a little harder. And I kept in touch with my doctor here in Nashville, and I'd let him know. And at one point, someone's mentioned a heart transplant, and someone else mentioned a valve. And but I just kept on going. I kept working out as much as I could. And health has always been at the forefront of my mind. Hmm. So I for most of my life, I thought about everything that I put in my mouth. Hmm. I thought, is this good for me or is this bad for me? It didn't stop me from eating bad things, but I would think about it as
right,
I did
right,
it.
Right.
You know, I think that's important. You know, for everyone. You know, you got to think about what you put in your mouth, because whatever you put in your body is what you become. You know?
Sure.
You are what you eat. And so, I was about 41, I think, and wound up in the hospital with a case of pneumonia. I went into the emergency room, and the doc says, "Wow, I think you're in heart failure." So that, you know, led to some tears, because I thought, mm-hmm. heart failure, that's it, I'm done.
Right.
I didn't know what it meant.
Right.
And he didn't explain, you know. And so,
as doctors will do, here's the diagnosis, I'll see you tomorrow. Yeah.
Well, I quickly fired him and I left that hospital and went to Vanderbilt University here in Nashville, where I met a great doctor named Dr. Frank Fish.
Yes. Who's very prominent in your book.
He's very prominent in our lives.
Yeah.
He's a great man, and he's a good friend to us. And he's been on this whole journey with me for the last 15, 16 years. Heart failure is a process, whereas like a heart attack is a moment. That happens at a moment in time. But heart failure, it's a process that takes years to develop in most cases. And it takes years to make itself known to its fullest. And by the time I was 49, things were not good. I had quit working out for about a year, and then I had a major stroke. And this was after they put a pacemaker in me earlier that summer. Then November, I had a major stroke. This was 2010.
Right.
And it was such a bad stroke, I woke up, I was totally paralyzed on the entire right side of my body, and I couldn't speak. And luckily, Erin was at home, and she heard me groaning in bed, and she called 911, and then they got me to the hospital and did surgery. And
you had somewhat of a, I don't want to say miraculous recovery from the stroke, but you really bounced back pretty quick.
I would say miraculous.
Would you?
They were saying, at first they said they didn't want to do the surgery on me because they thought it was too risky. They didn't know exactly how long it had been since I had the stroke, and they couldn't do an MRI on me because I had a pacemaker.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did a CT scan that showed a big portion of my brain had blood on it, and they thought, we can't tell how much of this is damaged, and they didn't want to do the surgery. And Dr. Frank Fish was, and he said, "Erin, what they're telling you is that what you have here is what you're going to get. He's going to remain paralyzed. Probably he'll never play the guitar again." And Erin, you know, said, "Please do the surgery." And so they did. And yes, it was miraculous that I'm doing as well as I am. But and I give all credit to these great doctors mm-hmm. and nurses. But I have to take a little bit of credit for me and Erin, because we have worked hard over the years. I mean, we didn't listen to them, because what they tend to say oftentimes is work hard, because after 6 months, that's about what you're going to get back.
Right.
If I'd quit at 6 months, I would not be playing the guitar again. I wouldn't be doing anything. I would be sitting on a couch with the remote control.
Yeah.
But I never believed that kind of statement from a doctor, you know, because they don't know. They don't know me. They don't know mm-hmm. my sense of drive.
Right.
They don't.
Those things aren't on a chart anywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. And, well, they just know what they see, but they haven't seen me, I guess.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
So we started working hard, but then in the midst of that, then heart failure hit, you know, 5 months or 6 months after I had the stroke.
Right, but I want to, Pete, hold on a second, because I want to go back to when Dr. Fish, Aaron, when Dr. Fish, because I was reading in the book, I'm going along, and I'm walking with you through this process, and when he said, Aaron, if they don't do this, you might as well just accept this is how he is. I had this overwhelming sense, it was like the, even though you made the phone call for 911 and all that, this was the first time it set in, like, this is, from this point on, every decision that made really has a lot of weight to it. When you go back to that time, it was obviously the choice to make, but do you remember how that felt, like, viscerally when you had to go through that?
Oh, yeah. That, I mean, it comes through in the chapter in the book, because I know that every time I read that chapter, I just become overwhelmed when it, you know, it takes me back in time. You know, I like to think that I'm on top of things and I'm paying attention to what the doctors are saying and that I'm good at making notes and making decisions. But that is one point where I really almost made the wrong decision. The right decision I made was to call Dr. Fish
Correct.
From the ambulance
yeah.
and say, meet us there, because I'm always concerned that with Pete's heart that doctors don't know his situation. So I was like, Dr. Fish there. So that was the right decision. But all I heard from these from the surgeons was risky, dangerous, and we'll treat him with medicine. So in my mind, I'm thinking, great, let's not risk surgery. Let's just give him some medicine and make him better. I totally was not understanding. And when Dr. Fish said, Aaron, what they're saying here is that this is he'll never play again. He might not ever speak again. And I mean, bang, that just hit me in the head. I had no idea that was the decision I was about to make.
Hmm.
And it was heavy. It was a heavy moment.
The book is called Joined at the Heart. We'll get a little bit longer into this. I want to talk about this marigold on the front, because I wear my emotions on my sleeve. If you listen to any of the shows that I do, it's not hard to tell that. When I started reading parts of this, I got pretty emotional over it. And even though we've only met briefly, and I look at these things and I think of the common challenges that people have that are in difficulty when it comes to their health and all that. And, you know, it's a cliche to say if you're healthy, you're wealthy. And that's true, because you could be at Carnegie Hall, which you have been. You can be playing with John Denver and Eric Clapton, Leon Rimes, which you have. You could have all this going on. But when the very thing that we take probably for granted the most, not saying that you did, but most people do, our health, that you know, whether it's something small that becomes large or something you're born with, you got to deal with your whole life, it somehow changes our perspective. When I'm reading through the book, I keep thinking of putting myself in that situation, going, how would I make this decision? How the hell did he, you know, start picking up the guitar again? I look at those things, and it's almost like the byproduct of the difficulties you've been through almost become the blessings that you'd rather skip the shit to get there, but they come anyway. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when I talk, I tell people, everyone goes through stuff. Everyone's going to have stuff in their life, you know. And I tell them, I'm going to tell you a lot of stuff I've had in my life, and my stuff is different than yours. But my stuff is my stuff, and yours, you know, maybe you only broke your leg. Maybe you lost a job. Maybe you lost a girlfriend or whatever. But it's your stuff, and it's heavy for you. And so mine's, you know, I just...
Right.
I think I've had, you know, a little more than my share, but yes, it does. It shapes who we are. You know, we're all shaped by events that happen in our lives and how we choose to deal with them. Because I think it's real important to know that we have a choice every day how we're going to react to whatever happens in that day.
You know, it's funny what you didn't hear, because I cut you off on the phone before. Was I was doing this whole opening, you'll hear on the show when it airs, about the difference between reacting and responding. And reaction is built in some ways out of the emotions that we have as human beings. Something happens in the news or whatever it is in our lives, and we react. And then eventually over time, the reactions become responses. We start to learn our responsibility and our ability to respond to all that's going on based on the challenges and the circumstances and the difficulties we've endured. And, you know, I'm listening to you talk, and I'm thinking, it's like when I called you, I'm like, every day's Thanksgiving for you guys, even though it's something that we say, it until something like this takes place in our lives, as you point out, whether it's a big thing or a small thing, we all have our bricks to build with. I'm listening to your voice going, the strength in your voice is reassuring to me that there is hope on the other side of the shit that goes on. And that's kind of the biggest thing that I took out of this. The book is called Joined at the Heart. A Story of Love and Guitars and Resiliency, and Marigolds, and Pete and Aaron Morris Huttlinger are the authors of the book. It's Pete's journey, really, through the challenges and changes of, I mean, being born with your organs on once the wrong side of your body to start with. Are you kidding me? And then becoming a world-class guitarist out of that and doing some amazing things. Even though those challenges remain, he has pushed past all that. Take a short time out. Take care of the people that take care of us. You're listening to Life Matters, because it does. But today it's about award-winning guitarist Pete Huttlinger and his wife, Erin. You know, he's really taken his music to the top of the mountain time and time and time again. Pete worked with the John Denver, touring the world, played Carnegie Hall, only to be tripped up by his congenitally damaged heart and had to start the journey all over again, losing all ability to do what he does best and loves best, which is play the guitar. And, of course, Erin with him the whole journey. And you guys, I was talking to you beforehand. One of the things I appreciate most about the book is that it comes from two perspectives. So you got Pete over here. And what did you say, Erin? If you just wrote Pete's part, it'd be really short.
Yeah, I said since he was unconscious or semi-conscious for a large portion of it, it would not have been a great full story.
No, it'd been crib notes, you know, like 6 pages long. This is what I remember. But Pete, when I look at the images, the photographs in here, I mean, you look like you were from Auschwitz at times. I mean, just the impact on your body, not just of what you were born with, but what you endured. You had the stroke and then you go into the heart failure and all the rest that goes with it. I mean, the appreciation, you already appreciated your gift before this all happened, but when you sit, were you practicing this morning when you're waiting for me to call?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So you're already on that, and that's something that is so vital to you. Has the appreciation for your gift upped at all, or has it just always kind of been how it's been for you through all this?
The appreciation, I don't think my appreciation for it has changed. I understand that it takes a lot of work to maintain a certain level of whatever we choose to do in our lives. You know, you have to work at it. Because whenever you stop working at it, you go backwards. There's no standing still. And so I don't know that I appreciate it anymore, but I sure love it more. I mean, I love when I get to sit down and play my guitar and the notes come out in the right order at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
It's really special.
Yeah.
It sounds silly to say that, but there was a period, you know, of about a year where for anyone who understands anything about the guitar, you know, when you have a flat pick in your hand, you play with a downstroke and an upstroke. You strum down, you strum up, down, up, down, up. Well, for about a year after I had a stroke, I could not do an upstroke.
Wow.
I knew what I was supposed to do. I just couldn't. I just had to rewire everything from my brain to my hand to make it go up. It would go down fine, but I couldn't go up. It was so weird. So in that sense, I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been a lot of hard work,
yeah.
You know. And I really didn't know if I wanted to after I got out of the hospital in Houston after I got a heart pump implanted and spent 4 months in the hospital there. I didn't know if I wanted to play the guitar again. You know, you said I looked kind of emaciated in those photos, and I was down to about 110 pounds. And playing the guitar hurt. It physically hurt, and I was kind of done with pain in my life. I didn't want to do it. But Erin, you know, left it out every now and then. She'd leave a guitar out, one in one room, one in another. And I'd pick it up, play for a couple minutes, and I'd curse and put it down. And the next day I'd pick it up again, or maybe a few days later I'd pick it up.
It kept magically reappearing. He kept hiding it in the case.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
He kept putting it in the case, and then he didn't, you know, he was pretty much either sitting on a couch or sitting in a chair during those months of recovery. And so
yeah.
I would just kind of lean it up, because I knew if he looked at it, I knew he wanted to, even though he was saying he didn't want to. I knew if he saw that special guitar sitting there, he couldn't resist picking it up. At least that's what I was praying for.
Some of the most interesting stuff in the book talks about the journey through ICU psychosis, which is a real thing. It's something that people in the intensive care unit have these things go on. And Erin, you talk about watching this or being around this, and that You know, that's one part of it is the physical thing that you're going through and getting a heart pump and all the. I mean, that's almost like like getting a tune-up. It's a mechanical part of this. But then there's this whole emotional, spiritual, mental thing going on that when I started reading that, that was, if not more fascinating than the mechanical stuff, because that, to me, speaks to a whole other part of who we are as human beings and what where we go when this stuff happens. Can you elaborate on that?
I think he had to go somewhere, or he couldn't have. He wouldn't have been able to withstand what was happening to him. I'm just guessing that must be one reason why people go to that place, because the horror of what their bodies are going through would just be overwhelming. So that's, you know, not a professional opinion, but that's just kind of my opinion. And being on the other side and watching them go through it, once you figure out that's what's happening to them and that's where they are. Because at first they just sound like they're mm-hmm. on too many painkillers or mm-hmm. something, and then he just slowly stopped talking to me, and his eyes were open and he was awake, but he just stopped speaking, and then, you know, every now and then he'd come around.
Did. Of course I did, Aaron. You wouldn't believe that I hosted a TV show with Leanne Rimes 10 days after I had heart surgery.
That's right. Well, that was the other thing. He was a little agitated with me that at first I learned to pretend like what he was saying really did happen, because when I first I thought he was being his funny self and he was mm-hmm. just joking about the things that he had done and the places he'd been, and when he realized I didn't believe him, he was not a happy camper.
And Pete, this was all vivid to you. I mean, it was all real deal.
It's still vivid. I could still picture the places I went and the things I did today as if they happened yesterday. I hosted a TV show with Leanne Rimes at the Opryland Hotel here in Nashville. And I showed up in the same clothes I was in the hospital in. And so Vince Gill was there. And Vince, he was a guest on our show. So he took
and you're wearing the and you're wearing the hospital gown?
No, I was in
the clothes.
Street clothes that I showed up to the hospital. But Vince was nice enough to see that I needed a change of clothes, so he said, "Pete, I'll take over and go get some clothes and come back." So thank him, and then Herb Peterson and Chris Hillman were guests on our show, and I all these things they're very real to me. Mm. And
the more I told him that they weren't real, the more he didn't trust me. Conspiracy theory going on. And that's why we included it in the book, because it was a very important aspect of what we went through, but specifically of what Pete went through, and we couldn't gloss over it. And that's why it needed to be there, and he needed to tell those stories.
Mm. Yeah, and you know what's interesting? No doctor has ever talked to us about that stuff.
Really?
Yeah. That just occurred to me, because, you know, I'm not the first person. You know, I have a cousin, George, who was in a car wreck a year ago, and he's been through it. And, you know, people who are in ICU for an extended period of time go through the psychosis. And I don't know why they're talking about it.
They label it for you, and they tell you that's what's happening, but they don't really tell you what's happening.
That's why they call it practicing medicine, guys, because they're still trying to figure some of this out. The name of the book is called Joined at the Heart, A Story of Love, Guitars, Resilience, and Marigolds, almost to the marigolds part, but I want to talk about the marathon first. It's a miracle in some ways you're still with us to do the great things that you do, and then you decide, I'm going to run a half marathon, I'm going to go out and do this. Obviously a testament to your drive and all those kind of things. Then you have a speed bump in there. That I found just kind of funny at some point. What happened when you're getting ready to do this?
I broke my damn leg.
After and everything I was, else.
I know it. I was thinking, really, God, really? A stroke and heart failure on enough. You got to break my leg, too? You know, what's going on here? And, I would have laughed if it were somebody else, but that was the only time I got mad at all the stuff I've been through in my life. You know, there have been a lot of suicides in my family, a lot of other deaths in my family. I was born with a bad heart. You know, I was chubby, and then I had a stroke and heart failure. I never got mad at that stuff. I just thought, all right, this is what I have to deal with. Now I'm going to deal with it. And then I break my leg about 2 months out from the marathon. And I wasn't going to run it, let me say. I was going to walk half marathon.
Sure.
Running is not in my horizon. But I thought, really? It was a stress fracture, let me say that. And it was from working out too hard, going up and down these hills. And we think that it happened because I had the stroke that I suffered affected the right side of my body, and it was my right leg, so it was my weaker side. And my right side is still weaker. It's been 5 years. But that's what happened. I broke my leg. But then I, worked through that. Thanks to Aaron and a different doctor. He said, you're not walking this thing. And Aaron got involved and talked him into letting me walk.
About to go over the edge on that one.
Mm-hmm.
So I jumped in and I said, let's not be too hasty. Let's wait six weeks, see how he does. If he's better, can he walk it? And he got better.
You know, the reason I asked you... and you just got better. That's just the way it's going to be.
Yeah.
That's a clear diagnosis, Pete. I'm sure you're used to that by this point, right?
Yeah.
I asked you guys to come on the show for a lot of reasons, but the biggest one is that, Pete, I want to go back to what you said, that we all have our, I say the word shit quite often. I said it before, you squeeze orange, you get orange juice. You squeeze tomatoes, you get tomato juice. Squeeze people, all kind of shit comes out. And we don't know what our shit is until it comes out, and we don't know what that's inside of us until we get squeezed. And you guys have been squeezed more than most people I know, but less than some other ones. So I look at this as what you said before about each of us kind of having our cross to bear, for lack of a better term. And I think that when you see what's all going on in the world, we have no control over, another mass shooting, another this, another that. I try to bring this show down to the level where people are living at right now in their own yards. I mean, it's important to know what's going on in the White House, but not as important as what's going on in your house. And sometimes we get our perspectives flipped around. We get so outwardly driven that we forget the stuff going on underneath our noses. And if we're really lucky, we have about 28,000 days to be alive, that it's easy to forget what's most important. Then life comes along, rattles your cage in a lot of different ways, brings us back to ground zero where we're at. And we have to look at ourselves and going to go, look what I'm learning about myself. So in the last few minutes we have together, I want to get to this Marigold things. Because when I got the book, I didn't realize why that would be on the cover. I was very intrigued by that. Aaron, why is there a Marigold on the cover of this book?
Well, so far, I've always told people, you just have to read the book. But I will share it with you.
Thank you.
It's just a small thread in there, but it meant a lot to me. And marigolds have always been Pete's favorite flower. At least that's what he told me, even, years before we were married. He said, I just love marigolds. I love that time of year when the marigolds come out. Just one of those little tidbits I'd picked up over the years. And so after we were married, I would always pot marigolds all around when they came out because I knew it meant something to him. And so when, after he was life-flighted from Vanderbilt University to Texas Heart in Houston, where we lived for about 4 months in the hospital, leading up to the surgery, things were dire. It was getting bad, even though there was a plan and I was hopeful. Things were really getting bad, and he was to the point where he couldn't move, he couldn't speak, and we were just waiting for the surgery for the heart pump to happen. And I would walk from the hotel to the hospital, and I just kept passing these huge beds of marigolds, and it was just kind of, ironic, obviously. And there's big signs all over ICU, no flowers, no food, no nothing. And I thought, in a week from now, he's either going to have made it through the surgery or he's not going to be alive.
Right.
I don't care.
Screw it.
And so, exactly. So I would pick these little marigolds and I'd shove them in my coat pocket. And when the nurses would leave the room, I would hold them up under his nose so he could smell them. Hmm. I'm still not sure if he liked it or not, because he couldn't speak.
Right.
But I was hopeful. And so that was just the little thread that we shared in the story.
I was really just touched by that because going back to, you have this ICU psychosis, which is a real thing that people experience, and no doctors mention that or prepare you for that, or there's no, download of that. The simple thing of taking a flower, walking in and putting it under someone you love's nose, to me, is more medicinal or more healing than all the protocol that goes. They did a great job, no questions. I don't mean to deride that, but just that when I read that, I thought, what if that was the pivot point? You know, what if that was the linchpin that brought the strength up a little bit more? We never know these things. It's just kind of like a ripple effect or even a puzzle that all the pieces need to be in order. When I read that, that's really what I got out of it. And the last thing I want to talk about here before I cut you guys loose is this concept that after all you've been through, you're asking people not just to be alive, but really be alive, to not just live, but live well. So your message in some ways has shifted into high gear.
Yeah, it sure has. And we look at this as an opportunity to share that with people. It's kind of the way Aaron and I have always lived our lives. We attack each day. We don't just get up and see what the day has to offer. You know, Aaron is a big list maker. She has a plan. She's going to go do it. So when we go out and I talk to people, the title of my speech is Don't Just Live, Live Well. And I'm telling them through my experiences, and there are many, as you know, how I'm living well. I'm not just sitting on the couch, going to the refrigerator and back to the couch, as are a lot of heart patients, you know.
And Pete, and there's a lot of people that have perfectly good hearts that do that too, and that's why I was asking you to say that. That's why I asked you that.
A lot of people are very healthy or could be very healthy, and they're just sitting, you know.
But I think there's an element.
I'm not here to change anyone. I'm not here to change anyone. I'm just here to give them our story and our perspective on all that we've been through, and we're still living a thriving life.
I think it's also an element of fear if somebody's gone through what Pete's gone through, almost paralysis can overtake people. They're afraid to move. They're afraid,
sure,
what's going wrong inside of me? And in the end, that can have a detrimental effect too, because you can't be so afraid.
Yeah. Last thing I want to ask you, because this is what I looked for, and I would look for, didn't know if I saw it clearly, faith as you define it. How did it play a role in all this? You know, Pete, you said before you got through all this, you break your leg, and then you get pissed at God. So how has your faith changed, increased, been reinforced? What came out of that as you define it?
I'm still actually wondering if there is a God. You know, I was raised by a Christian mom. You know, she was Catholic, and then she became born again. But I just see so many things in the world. I'm like, how can my God be better than everyone else's God? How can everyone else's God be worse than my God? You know, there are 7 billion of us on the planet. If we all don't believe in the same God, then they're doomed to hell. I just don't get that stuff. It just doesn't make sense to me. I have faith in the goodness of people. I have great faith in doctors and nurses and in my wife. And I don't know. That's where I am with religion these days, you know. I just don't know. And I admire people who do know. And they say, no, I'm right. And so I'm like, okay, well, good for you. But for me, I just don't know.
Mm. Aaron?
You know, because here's what I'm thinking these days. Seven members of my family, my immediate family, are dead.
Yes.
Seven members. So I've got one brother and one sister left. And I've been born with a bad heart, and I had a stroke, and I had heart failure and all this. And God loves me. Really? Could he love me a little less? I mean, really? I got to go through all this? And I don't understand the point why I'm going through all this. You know, there are people who tell me, oh, God has a plan for you. And I say, I sure wish he'd let me know what it is. I'm ready. I'm ready for the test, you know, whatever. Yeah. But I just I don't know. That's where I am. Okay, sweetie, over to you.
I don't have a better answer for you, John. I was raised in an agnostic family, so I don't know where that sits with me either, and I just don't know how to answer that. I mean, I obviously feel there's something larger than me at work that gets us through all this, that makes us, that we're here able to talk to you, but I don't know what that is.
Let me tell you something, how refreshing it is to have two people say, I don't know. Because we live in a world where you're supposed to know everything and have it all figured out. And, you know, we live in this world that is a this or that world, meaning you're a man or you're a woman, you're a Democrat or you're Republican, you're black or you're white or you're red or you're whatever. And when you do the this or that dance, you leave out half of the possibilities of what could be for your experience of being alive. And so I've always been a big proponent of this and that. So how do I take the Huttlinger's experience and then how do I incorporate what you went through, which I didn't, into my life to enhance the way that I see the world? So how do I do the and dance with reading your story or listening to the show? And I think once we start to get to this and that, then we are really honest about, I don't know. And I just found that, I'm sitting here with my mouth kind of hanging open, not because I didn't expect any different answer, but it just takes, it's courageous to go through what you've gone through, anybody goes through, and say, I don't know. So I appreciate that. I really do. That's very different. Very, very different. Very, very different. The book is called Joined at the Heart, A Story of Love, Guitars, Resilience, and Marigolds. Pete Huttlinger and his wife, Erin Morse Huttlinger. Forward written by John Oates of Hall & Oates. It's fantastic. It's out everywhere, right, you guys?
Yeah, Amazon and
you can get it our website, which is PeteHuttlinger.com.
Remember when Amazon was just a river?
Yeah.
What a good time that was, huh? And spam was something in a can, then undo with email. It was a good time. I really appreciate your time out today, these guys. I look forward to staying in touch with you. And go check out the book. It's fantastic. It will reflect not just your journey, but really, I think all of our journeys when you go through this. And I think so much of this stuff is in disguise that the only way we would learn some of the lessons that life has to offer us is if we were knocked over the head or, in Pete's case, kind of grabbed by the heart. Back with more right after this.
You're listening to Life Matters with John St. Augustine.
So that's going to wrap it up for another episode of Life Matters. My thanks again to Pete and Erin Huttlinger. Their book is called Joined at the Heart, A Story of Love, Guitars, Resilience, and Marigolds. And as I said to them off the air, I probably, you know, in the miracle of technology, this little break was 30 plus seconds, maybe 32 seconds, but we've been chatting for 15 minutes after the show. And one of the things I said to them, and I want to say to you, because I'm reminding myself at the same time, there is so much in the world that says life doesn't matter. You can find it everywhere. It'll find you. If you don't find it, it'll find you. I disagree. I vehemently disagree. I totally disagree with that. So no matter what's going on out there, I think the key is to make sure that doesn't corrupt us in here. And that's so easy for us to do until these wake-up calls come, as I've alluded to many, many times in the talks that I do, with the shows that I do, the books I've written, all this stuff. I think the big aha in all this is that, yeah, we're creating all this shit. There's not an alien species come dumping on us, unless you listen to somebody else's show that does UFO stuff. But we do this to ourselves, and we do it to each other. And it's all based on the beliefs that we hold. And yeah, there's some people with some wiring that doesn't fit or work, and it gets crossed. I get that. But for the most part, this is what we do to ourselves, and we allow it. And when you start allowing this stuff, it expands. My Native American friends taught me a word many years ago called Pichko. And Pichko says that which expands keeps expanding for better or for worse. Doesn't matter. Pichko, that which expands keeps expanding. It's the ripple effect, basically. And it doesn't matter if it's a positive thing or a negative thing. If we keep feeding it, it keeps expanding. And that's the world we live in. Even with all that said and having a consciousness about that, we have to understand something. We are responsible for all of it. Doesn't matter what color you are, doesn't matter what gender you are, doesn't matter where you live. We're all in this biosphere together, knocking the crap out of each other and consoling each other when it happens, that which we impart. And so what I hope you got a little bit out of the show, which I did reading their book, is life's tough enough without making it more difficult. And if we could figure out some ways to be a little kinder and gentler in the world to each other, maybe that ripple effect spreads out and things that were going to happen, maybe they don't. I don't know. Maybe it's an energetic thought. Maybe it's a prayer. Really can't define it. But all I do is know is this, that life matters unless you decide that it doesn't. Till next time, adios.